Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Remember all the complaining about banks not using bailout money to make loans? Congress wondering where that $250 billion was going? Well, newsflash from Detroit, GM's financing arm says it's got $6 billion to play with. Applications now being accepted. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, the email marketing service dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits succeed. ConstantContact.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is December 30th, a Tuesday. Good to have you here. And listen, if you've been trying to buy a car made by General Motors, but you couldn't quite qualify for the loan, why don't you go ahead and call the dealer to see if your luck has changed? Late last night, GM's financing arm got a $6 billion shot in the arm thanks to the Treasury Department. Today, it announced five-year no-interest loans to a lot of prospective buyers whose credit scores had been too low to qualify. For now, the GMAC bailout is a way for the struggling car maker to buy some time. But our senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports it might also be buying some trouble over the long term.
When GMAC set the magic number to qualify for a car loan at a credit score of 700 or above, it shut out millions of prospective buyers.
Very few people would qualify at that FICO score. GMAC just wasn't in the game.
Brendan Moore works as an auto financing industry consultant and publishes the website autosavant.com. He says by loosening up and qualifying buyers with credit scores above 620, GMAC is suddenly back in the marketplace.
They can now go after deals that they couldn't go after just 48 hours ago.
The government rescue doesn't just free up money for would-be buyers. Last year, GMAC financed about three-quarters of GM's dealership inventory. Eric Merkel is lead auto analyst at Crowe Horwath.
Very few people are going to drive to the plant to pick up their car, so it's important that GM keeps their dealerships viable going forward.
But the deal with the government means GM is losing even more control of the financing arm that was set up decades ago specifically to promote sales of its cars. GM had already sold a 51% share of GMAC in 2006 to Cerberus, the private equity firm that owns Chrysler. Now, Automotive News publisher Keith Crane says GMAC is becoming its own business with its own goals.
GMAC is going to want to make money, and they're not going to want to subsidize the sales of General Motors and lose money in that end for the good of GM.
Crane points out Ford Motor Credit remains under Ford's control, and he says this deal could put GM at a real disadvantage if GMAC strays too far from its original mission. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
We'll have some more on the crash test year that Detroit's had coming up in just a couple of minutes. First, though, a detour into another economic pothole. The latest housing stats are out. As expected, they are dismal. The S&P Case-Shiller Housing Index dropped 18% in October. That's from a year ago. It is also the biggest fall since the index was created almost 9 years ago, and it puts home prices where they were in 2004. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner has more.
October was a chilling month in the U.S. housing market. All of the cities in the Case-Shiller Index saw home prices sink. That includes Boston, Chicago, Tampa, and Seattle, among others. The worst declines were in the West. Home values in Phoenix, Las Vegas, and San Francisco plunged more than 30%. David Blitzer is chairman of S&P's index committee. He says the numbers were no surprise, but October was particularly nasty.
This was the time when the credit crunch or the mortgage crisis, whatever term you want, really landed on the entire economy and all of us like a ton of bricks.
Tim Griske, chief investment officer at Solaris Asset Management, says also keep in mind this particular index is limited to 20 metropolitan areas, and many of them are in states like Florida and California with overbuilt housing markets and high foreclosure rates.
They were the markets where there was a lot of speculation by contractors and by other real estate speculators, individuals owning multiple homes, believing that home prices would go up forever.
Still, Griske says, they're sobering numbers. This is the 27th month in a row that this housing index has recorded losses. If there is a silver lining, Griske says, it's that the country's inventory of unsold homes is now shrinking. He expects home prices to stabilize by the end of 2009, if not sooner. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
It's clear this year's holiday season was pretty grim for retailers, the grimmest, in fact, in a long time. Stores weren't really able to fend off disaster with those pre-Christmas sales, which has led to a very uncomfortable question bouncing around the retail industry. Who's going to pay for those steep discounts we got? Stores or the companies that made all the merchandise? Marketplace's Janet Babin reports from North Carolina Public Radio.
Maybe you got this pre-Christmas email, too. Buy one cashmere sweater, get two free. Now, who's paying for that? The company that makes the sweater or the company that sells it? Retail analyst Marshall Cohen at the NDP Group says it depends.
That first 25 and even sometimes up to the 40% off is generally split between the retailer and the manufacturer. When they start to discount the product below 60% off, nobody's making any money.
That's what happened this year. Now, manufacturers are renegotiating with department stores to decide who will lose less. Lou Bruning at HMS Production sells cable and gauge sweaters at Dillard's and Macy's. He says the stores have agreed to price concessions for the first time. Not that it'll do his business much good.
We don't come out ahead because of the renegotiated situations.
Not all apparel makers have been able to cut a deal. Here's designer Alexander Julian.
I haven't heard of any stores being generous to the people that make my product.
But there are deeper implications to all this discounting. Wendy Liebman at WSL Strategic Retail says customers could question whether stores are giving them the best deal possible during the spring shopping season.
When they started doing, you know, two cashmere sweaters for the price of one, was I paying too much in the beginning?
Steeper discount allowances might be here to stay for retailers and manufacturers. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
The penultimate trading day of 2008 went in the books a winner. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If by some chance you hadn't heard, the American automobile industry is in a whole mess of trouble. It's been struggling for years, of course. But somehow things came to a head in just the last couple of months. Marketplace's Elisa Roth has spent a lot of time covering Detroit for us this year. Hi, Elisa.
Hi, Kai.
All right, so today's GMAC news aside, catch us up on this crazy year Detroit's had.
Well, the big news is obviously more money for GM and Chrysler. They finally got $17.4 billion from the Treasury Rescue Fund. Ford does say it has enough cash for now, but Kirk Kerkorian did sell off the rest of his Ford shares yesterday. The other big news was that this might have been the year that ended SUVs and trucks. The record high gas prices this summer really did in that business, and car sales generally are way down. And I think we can probably expect them to be at least that bad, if not worse, in the coming year.
Well, you mentioned Ford, and it said it's doing okay. What about GM and Chrysler?
Well, they both have until March to come up with solid plans for how they will get profitable. That doesn't mean they have to be profitable by the end of March, but they do have to show how they will get there. There have been rumors on and off for months now that there could be a merger that would be GM buying Chrysler, but it's quite unclear whether that would actually happen, and it's still a little unclear to me, at least, who would gain what from it.
Define solid plans, though. Didn't they get sent away by Congress to come up with a plan and they came back and now they have to do another plan?
Yeah, I mean, they have plans. They showed Congress their plans, but they really have to show very specific ideas of how they're going to restructure their companies in ways that can be sustained.
What about the people who will be doing that building, the members of the United Auto Workers Union? Now, Ron Gettelfinger, the head of the union, was at that long green table with the CEOs.
Their part in this has been really mixed. I mean, I think in the last, let's say, couple of years, all three parties, that is the Detroit Three, the UAW, and the workers, have kind of realized that they are all on the same side of these negotiations, that basically their job collectively is to make sure that these companies don't go under, because if anyone goes under, they're all going to be in trouble. That said, Ron Gettelfinger has publicly said we're not making any concessions. But earlier this month, there was a big meeting in Detroit, and the UAW actually agreed to a couple of big changes, including discussing their current contracts, allowing the companies to delay their payments to the big healthcare funds, and getting rid of the jobs bank. And I think we can probably expect that there will be more concessions ahead. Among other things, the loans from the government require that they get their pay rates down to roughly what the foreign car makers in the U.S. are paying.
You know, Lisa, much as we've been trying to figure out what Wall Street's going to look like in the months and years to come, so are we trying to figure out what Detroit and the U.S. auto industry is going to look like. What do you think?
I think that the next 3 months are going to be very, very informative and crucial. Obviously, it's going to depend in part on what President-elect Obama and his administration decide are acceptable levels of profitability and how much more help the companies might need. I think what is clear is that the auto industry, both here and abroad, is never going to be the same. I think there are going to have to be changes to the products, that is, more fuel-efficient cars, cars that people are more interested in buying, and changes to the business model. I think the really big question here is this finally the end of manufacturing in the U.S.? And if it is, where does that leave semi-skilled or unskilled workers? You graduate from high school, and what are your options? And at this point, they're few and far between.
Answers to all those questions and more in the new year. Marketplace's Elisa Roth for us from New York. Thanks, Elisa.
You're welcome, Kai.
Tokyo's Nikkei Stock Index wrapped up trading for the year today, down 42%. We're going to have to wait another day to get 2008 totals from Wall Street, but pretty it is not going to be. The year's losses on the stock market are bad enough for companies and their investors, but there is an extra downside for some firms that bought back a lot of their own stock. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains.
Macy's, The New York Times, Gannett, Home Depot. They're among a long list of companies that went on a stock buyback spree in the past few years in an effort to drive up their earnings per share and their stock price.
What seemed like a good idea a couple of years ago may not seem like one today.
Nick Riccio is managing director of corporate ratings at Standard & Poor's. He says many companies finance their buybacks with borrowed money. Now they have to pay off that long-term debt at a time when they're not making much and additional credit's hard to come by.
We don't get too carried away if companies live within their means. If they're generating excess cash and they use that to buy back stock, they're not levering up. They're not really impeding their future cash flow at all. But when you start borrowing money for that, I think you kind of compound the risk level.
That risk is reflected in the company's credit ratings, many of them at or near junk bond grade. University of Portland finance professor Richard Gritta says there's not much light at the end of the tunnel.
You could sell new stock and use that new stock to extinguish some of the debt. But the problem is these stock prices are hitting rock bottom.
Gritta predicts it'll take these companies years to sell investors enough stock or consumers enough stuff to get out of the financial hole they're in. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
I'm going to go out on a ledge here and make a market prediction for tomorrow. With less than a half a day of trading coming to us on New Year's Eve, it's probably safe to assume we're not going to see the crazy gyrations that made this fall so stomach-turning. But volatility is still going to be center stage. The New York Stock Exchange is going to announce its new emergency circuit breakers tomorrow. That is, if the Dow Industrials fall by a certain amount, trading comes to a halt. We asked Jeremy Hobson what it would take to shut things down in today's edition of the Marketplace Decoder.
Until tomorrow, here are the numbers. A drop of 1,100 points would shut down trading for an hour if it happens before 2 p.m. Eastern. A 2,200-point decline before 1 p.m. would mean a two-hour halt. And a 3,300-point drop would send everyone home, or perhaps to the bar, regardless of the time. Those numbers are determined quarterly by the New York Stock Exchange. They're based on a percentage of the market at the time of the determination. David Henderson works the floor of the NYSE for his company, Raven Securities. He's glad circuit breakers exist.
If we didn't shut down, I mean, where would it go to? I mean, it really prevents a meltdown, so to speak.
Oh, without a doubt. We want those circuit breakers. Give people rest, stop, and reorganize.
That's Alan Valdez of Hilliard Lyons.
You know, a lot of trading the last few months have been on emotions instead of fundamentals. So when you get a circuit breaker, you stop those emotions, everybody catches their breath, and they can reorganize.
The NYSE circuit breakers have only actually been triggered twice, on the same day back in 1997. the world was in the midst of the Asian financial crisis.
Bloodshed on the U.S. financial markets. It's down, down, down for the Dow.
On Marketplace that night, listeners heard from a couple of traders who stood outside the exchange smoking cigarettes while the markets were closed.
It's basically to let everything, the system catch up, let all the work and all the paperwork catch up. Let's just reevaluate our position.
It gives people time to sit back, relax, and see what's going to happen.
1997 was a lifetime ago in the world of trading, but the circuit breakers emerged out of market turmoil in 1987. That was two lifetimes ago technologically.
Back in those days, people traded with people, and they had problems with printers jamming when they had printers that would print the order tickets.
Finance professor James Angel of Georgetown University says circuit breakers are outdated since most trading is now done electronically. And Angel says there's another problem with them.
A lot of investors who have orders to sell something by the end of the day don't know when the end of the day is going to be. So if they think that there is a chance that you're going to hit that circuit breaker, they may sell faster before the market closes, making the decline even worse.
Angel says a modern solution could be individual breakers for individual stocks, but he doesn't think any change is likely. A spokesman for the New York Stock Exchange confirms that prediction. He says the only change will be the routine updating of just how big a drop it takes to trigger circuit breakers. That number will likely come down dramatically tomorrow because it's a percentage of the Dow's current levels, and the markets have lost a lot of ground this quarter. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Coming up, ethanol can give small engines big problems.
The corrosive properties, what you'd see is much like what you see on the top of dirty battery terminals.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gained 184 points today, 2.1% to finish at 8668. The Nasdaq gained 40 points, 2.2%, ended at 1550. The S&P 500 added 21 points, 2.4%, closed at 890. That bailout of GMAC, General Motors financing arm, shored up hope that Washington will do whatever it takes to soften the deep recession we're in. General Motors, which announced 0% financing, as we told you about, drove up 5.5% today. Ford Motor gained more than 3%. Big tech companies with healthy cash reserves picked up steam as investors bet they might weather bad times. Wireless chipmaker Qualcomm recharged 2.5% today. The 10-year T-note gained, pushing the yield down to 2.08%. Keep an eye on that one, gang. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, global provider of fuels, power, and energy services. Committed to sound, efficient, sustainable energy solutions. Constellation.com. And by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor. Online at FINRAFoundation.org. Want more from Marketplace's special Fallout coverage? It's all on our website. You'll find special podcasts, explainers, and videos. Go to marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. It's the last trading day of the year. Don't look back. The trial of the Iraqi journalist who threw his shoes at President Bush was originally scheduled to begin tomorrow. It has been postponed. And 2008 gets a teensy-weensy bit longer. Timekeepers add a leap second to the clock just before next year to keep pace with the finicky rotation of the Earth. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We had a cold snap here in L.A. a week or so ago. I know, 40 degrees doesn't really compare to the weather in most parts of the country, especially the Northeast. People there keep a real close eye on the price of home heating oil. This past summer, with prices looking like they were only going to keep going up, there was a great temptation to lock in winter contracts at almost $5 a gallon. Heating oil has dropped to less than $2.50 today. So as part of our look back at some of our coverage this past year, we thought it'd be a good time to call up oil retailer Peter Bourne. He runs Bourne's Energy in Morrisville, Vermont. And here's part of what he told our reporter, Jane Lindholm.
A 74-year-old lady who's been a customer for 16 years and asking, is there anything you can do? And I'm saying, I can't do a thing. That's the worst, because I know people are going to be hurting, and there's not a damn thing I can do about it.
Peter Bourne, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for calling.
Whatever happened with that woman?
Well, that woman did not get on a program at all. I mean, she just didn't have the ability to do it. And so fortunately, as I think everybody's aware, that the market's dropped enough that she's okay. She's keeping track of her oil herself. She's not on automatic delivery.
What about the rest of your customers and how they're feeling? I mean, you know, when they were buying these contracts, home heating oil was going up toward $5 a gallon, and now it's, you know, dropped almost half that much. How are the rest of them doing?
Generally speaking, the customers are doing fine. For the people that did the cap pricing, and the cap pricing issue required a fee up front.
Mm-hmm. The cap pricing being buying those futures contracts.
That's correct, but this was buying it with the downside, so that, you know, if the market dropped, they were able to drop with the market. And those people, as we know in retrospect, made a good decision, because as our retail prices dropped, which it has significantly, from we were a high of $4.80, and now we're in the mid $2 level as we speak today. So they're paying that price instead of the $4.80 that we were at. The ones that locked in for a fixed price this year, that was not, as it turns out, wasn't the way to go.
Did you learn anything this past 6 months with this wild swing in oil prices that you're going to use this coming summer and fall as you start pricing things?
Every year, Kai, it's a different game. It really is never the same. What I did last year is not what I can do next year. But the one thing is, with the markets what they are and recognize the volatility, is trying to make sure we don't have customers in positions that are going to be as adverse as some of the ones that locked into a fixed pre-buy this year. That was, they're really feeling abused. I understand that. We're feeling abused, but we're buying that oil at a price that's just ridiculous in relation to today's market.
What about that piece of tape we played right at the beginning of the interview? And the last thing you said there was, there's not a damn thing you can do about some of these people and their situation. Where does that leave you as a businessman?
That just leaves a hole in your stomach, and you just, it's helpless. It's, I don't know, it's like watching your kid dive off the dock and knowing they can't swim.
Peter Bourne runs Bourne's Energy. It's in Morrisville, Vermont. He spoke to Jane Lindholm earlier this past year about the rising price of oil and home heating oil up in Vermont. You can hear that story on our website. It's marketplace.org. Mr. Bourne, thanks so much for your time.
Well, thank you.
Today's renewable fuel news comes with a dateline of Wellington, New Zealand. Air New Zealand has flown a test flight, its first, using a 50-50 blend of regular jet fuel and biofuel. The mixture kept a 747 in the air for 2 hours. Everybody's looking for ways to use biofuels. Washington says the U.S. is going to have to produce 36 billion gallons of them, mostly ethanol, by 2022. But alcohol, which is essentially what ethanol is, can be murder on lawnmowers and engines a whole lot smaller than the ones on 747s. Wyoming Public Radio's Peter O'Dowd reports that as gas blended with ethanol takes over, small engines across the country could start choking to death.
At the Wyotech Automotive School in Laramie, Wyoming, Larry Wastenberg likes to conduct experiments with engines for his students. Today's test, how much ethanol a small engine can take before it breaks down.
We're going to put a little choke action on here and start this baby up.
Wastenberg pours alcohol into a lawnmower's fuel tank. His supervisor, Jack Longris, explains why using too much ethanol can destroy this kind of engine.
It's a recipe for disaster, because eventually when those pieces get brittle, they're more susceptible to breaking.
Alcohol makes engines run dangerously hot. It melts rubber components. Longris says use anything higher than 10% ethanol on small engines long enough and the insides will start to rot.
The corrosive properties, what you'd see is much like what you see on the top of dirty battery terminals.
Drivers of flex fuel cars don't have to worry much. Their onboard computers can regulate fuel mixtures. But small engines like Wyotech's lawnmower don't have those features. They're more likely to malfunction if they're filled with the wrong blend. And broken engines can mean injured operators. That's just one of the reasons why Chris Kaiser is so worried. He's with AllSafe, an advocate group for small engine manufacturers.
What we're concerned about are mid-level blends entering into the marketplace in advance of consumers being educated about their use and what their effects will be.
Kaiser says millions of chainsaws, lawnmowers, and boats could be vulnerable to death by ethanol. This year, the government ordered the production of 9 billion gallons of renewable fuel. A decade from now, that number will grow to 26 billion gallons. As the mandate expands, Kaiser says higher blends of ethanol will be pumped from every gas station in America. And unless people know what they're doing, he says they could easily fill up with a blend far too potent for their machines.
If they drive up to a pump and they see E20, E30, E40, I don't think they know what that means. Even if they do know what it means, that E30 means 30% ethanol in the gallon they're producing, if they're selling it at the pump, I think there's an assumption that it's okay, that it's going to work in whatever I put it in.
That's kind of a moot point. We've already got those concerns.
Ron Lamberty works for the American Coalition of Ethanol. He points out that consumers are quite capable of telling the difference between diesel and regular fuel at the gas station. He says America's well on the road to using more renewable fuels like ethanol. Small engine manufacturers can either protest, he says, or start improving their products.
If we always listened to the naysayers, we would be still sitting here with, you know, leaded regular gasoline in the United States. We've got to move forward, and the small engine guys have to come along.
Critics say they might come along more quickly if the science were more definitive. No one really knows exactly how sensitive small engines are to ethanol. The standard threshold for lawnmowers, for example, is 10%, but our experiment showed it could run on a much richer mixture. The Department of Energy published a study on ethanol and small engines this fall. You can check just how deadly the fuel might be to your old John Deere. In Laramie, Wyoming, I'm Peter O'Dowd for Marketplace.
We've got a link to that study that Peter just mentioned on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, hopefully the last out of Detroit you'll hear this year. Ford says it knows how to get customers back, cars that park themselves. The company said today the 2010 Lincoln sedan will do it for you. You are still going to have to work the brake and the gas, though. It's going to be formally introduced at the Detroit Auto Show next month, and I know there's some kind of crash analogy to make here with the whole industry. I just can't think of it. That is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Tuesday. Today, the Dow rose 184 points, 2.1%. The NASDAQ added 40 points, 2.2%. The S&P 500 gained 21 points. That's 2.4% there. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Renita Jablonski on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Coming up next time on this program, reading the stock market's star chart.
Pluto is at 0 degrees Capricorn. The last time that happened was 1776, the American Revolution. The country has a big change coming.
Wow. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.